I mean, in the next slide we have. Okay, next slide we have some typical data. Now, if anybody out there is in the X-ray fluorescence biz, he'll probably say, man, those are the worst spectra I've ever seen. But the work was done under rather severe constraints, the most serious of which was a time constraint. And the counting time was limited to 30 minutes, about 2,000 seconds, 33 minutes. And there isn't much of anything there is the problem. So you have a very low signal with the normal amount of noise, and therefore you have a fairly low signal to noise ratio, but it's still not so bad that you can't drag anything out. The top spectrum is a typical spectrum from a non-blood area, and they all looked almost the same, although they weren't quite. The bottom one is a spectrum from the side wound area, and it's typical of the blood, and you'll say, hey, there's a big difference here. And he's going to tell me that's another artifact, but that turns out to be the iron peak. The peak at 6.4 kilovolts is characteristic of iron. And it was at this point that it was realized that there is something really different between the image and the background, and it looks like iron. The other peaks in here, why don't we have the next slide, because what I want to do is explain a little bit about what these different peaks mean. This is an average, it's a composite spectrum. If you take a bunch of data and average a bunch of data that look nominally the same, you know, or are supposed to be the same, average them, you can increase the signal to noise ratio. You can smooth things out and see features a little bit better, and that's what we've done here, just to illustrate what these different peaks are. This is a composite average of the scan of the face. What we have here is one. One is just a low energy background peak, and it is the same in this spectrum. And I forgot to tell you what the bottom one is, because that's very important. That is a spectrum that was taken from Wattman number 42 filter paper that has nothing in it, so that any of the artifacts that arise from the X-ray tube, impurities in the secondary target, whatever, should show up on this and not on this. The bottom line is that if we identify all of these peaks, if we identify which peaks here are artifacts from this, then we know which peaks are real and represent the actual elements on the shroud. Number two, I think, is, let's see, I can't see. Number two is a calcium peak, and it's not down here in this this control spectrum. Number three is an iron. Number four, it turns out, see, you can see them here. See where those line up? It turns out that number four is some multiply reflected fluorescent radiation from the tube target. Number five, I believe, are lead peaks. You know, we had this all surrounded by lead, and there are a lot of X-rays scattering around here. So there was some contribution to the spectrum from the lead target. And number seven is also a real peak, but because it's not seen here. So the real peaks that we have left are 2, 3, and 7, calcium, iron, and strontium. If I could. Okay. Could I have the next slide, please? Okay. We'll get to that in just a minute. You're saying, so where did calcium and strontium and iron come from? And at the time, we wrote the paper 2 years ago. it looked at, we suspected that probably the calcium and the strontium just came from dust deposits in the air, because the shroud has been in Turin, Italy for hundreds of years, up in a marble producing region, and there's a lot of calcium carbonate floating around. And I had suspected that where you see calcium, you will see strontium, and as a general rule, I thought that was true, although in the last few days we're beginning to rethink that position. Since then, there has been more work on with the tape studies that you'll be listening to next. It was found that there really isn't all that much dust, nothing that could account for the amount of calcium. There's something like 200 micrograms of calcium per square centimeter, and that accounts for about 1 weight percent of the cloth itself. It's really a terribly large amount. It was later suggested, in the absence of the evidence for dust, you believe that. Since there was no dust on the tape, someone came up with another hypothesis, and that someone will be speaking next, that this calcium and strontium, and perhaps also the iron, which is also fairly uniform in the non-blood stains, was actually became attached to the cellulose molecule through an ion exchange process while the linen was being readed. That's a part of the manufacturing process of linen back in the olden days. And there's also further evidence. I think they'll have a few words more to say about that in a few minutes. In the blood areas, you noted, if you'll remember from the earlier slide, we saw a significant difference in the iron concentration. I mean, there's a real difference. You can really see it. And if you do some sort of quantitative analysis, you can calculate that this difference represents about 30 to 40 micrograms per square centimeter above measured or inferred backgrounds in those regions. And you say, big deal, so what? It doesn't imply anything by itself, but we measured whole blood iron. We found there were about 0.5 micrograms per cubic millimeter, and that about 25 cubic millimeters saturated at 1 square centimeter area of Wattman 42. And if you do your arithmetic right, you can estimate from those measurements just how much iron you might expect from a blood stain from a blood stain on cloth. And it turns out that the difference in the iron concentration that we see in the blood areas is roughly what you might expect if the shroud areas were indeed blood. So you say, hey, great, that's neat. But it doesn't prove anything, because if you remember from right in the beginning of the talk, we said that you only see atoms, and what's important for blood is how the atoms are attached. This technique couldn't tell the difference between blood and an iron paint, for instance. But it's still very strong corroborating evidence, and the first evidence that we had, I might add, that the stains were blood. There's one more thing I'd like to say, and that is that there were two more things I wanted to say. First of all, in the blood areas, if you do X-ray fluorescence on blood, you also see potassium, and there were no potassium peaks seen in the spectra, but there were also quite a lot of difficulties involved. The potassium peak is about an order of magnitude, about a 1/10 of the iron peak, and there was an awful lot of noise down there. And there is also the added complication that the potassium compounds in blood are soluble, and there are medical people felt that there was really no good reason for potassium to be there, and if it had been there, we probably wouldn't have been able to see it anyway. So the absence of potassium does not disprove that blood is there. The last thing I want to talk about was this slide. And I was actually supposed to point to this about a minute ago, because this is a plot of iron concentration in micrograms per square centimeter going up this axis right here. And this is distance in centimeter along the scan line. Now, you remember along the foot scan, that first slide I showed you, where we started on the bloody spot and just kind of marched off into the background region. Well, this is right on the blood stain, right here, and here we're marching off into the background region. These squares are the data for the foot scan iron concentrations. And on the next slide after that, I showed you pointed out that face scan where you started at the nose and marched across the face and wound up on the little blood trickle over on the side. Well, you'll notice here that the iron concentrations on the nose and also on the blood stain on the side are slightly above the measured quantities in between. Now, we've since learned that the blood is indeed blood, and so a slightly elevated iron concentration here is reasonable. Over here on the nose, it turns out that if you look at the tip of the nose very carefully, there's some particulate matter there, so that the very tip of the nose isn't all image. There's some other crud there. And it just warns us that a simple explanation for the presence of iron or any other element may not be sufficient. Some of this iron, you know, may just be particulate material in the cloth and whatnot, and that certainly is a contributing factor here at the tip of the nose. But right now I think we have the X-ray fluorescence results nailed down pretty well. And we'd like to do it again for longer counting periods, because from this study we've learned the right questions to ask. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Larry. Get some lights, please. Can we have the house lights a little bit, please? The next speaker on the question of blood on the shroud would be John Heller, New England Institute, Ridgefield.
This is going to be the joint presentation by myself and Dr. Alan Adler. We've changed our mind three times who's going to present what, the last change being about 5 minutes before we arrived here. So basically it was decided that I would stand here and wave my arms around a lot, and that he would show you slides and pictures and some spectra. I kind of have the feeling that you've been spectred to death a little bit by seeing all these spectra, but this is one of the ways that we work and get our answers. It was about 3 years ago, a little more, and I was a new boy on the team, and I sat down and had a talk with Dr. Ray Rogers, who was telling me what he thought from the evidence then available, photographic and otherwise, what the shroud might probably be and might not be. And I wished I had a record of that conversation, because he was prescient. He predicted almost everything that we wound up finding. Might as well stayed home for a certain amount of the degree, because he was so on target with so much of his thinking, because he is a brilliant and insightful man and derived a huge amount from very little evidence that had gone before. The initial problem that we were going to have to solve was a little one, we thought. It was Is the blood blood? And as you notice on these pictures of the shroud that you've seen, the shroud itself looks like a photographic negative, light and dark are reversed, left and right are reversed. But the blood isn't. So, is it blood or is it red paint or what indeed is it? And we rather fancied, and I found out later that I wound up being called a blood specialist, which is the last thing in the world that I am. But we have some methods for measuring very minute amounts of things, and blood is one of them. And we figured if there was any blood on there, why, we could probably get it pretty solidly. There is a structure in nature, which is an organic chemical structure called a porphyrin. And in the middle of these porphyrins, there are single atoms of metal. In chlorophyll, it's magnesium. In blood, it's iron. It's one atom in the middle, and it's surrounded by the rest of the porphyrin molecule. And Ray Rogers was interested in porphyrins, and I said, Ray, if there's a heme porphyrin, which is what the one that's in blood there, don't worry, we'll nail it. And I was to swallow my words with great indigestion subsequently, because when I received the first slide back from Turin, I saw some stuff which I thought was blood, and I didn't know how to nail it. What Ray Rogers had done over there was to take sticky tape samples of a specially made up tape and adhesive, and a nifty gadget which put so many grams of pressure against the shroud so that when the tape was pulled off, there wouldn't be any damage done to it. And these tape samples were the specimens that were brought back. And if you want to know what it looks like, take a piece of scotch tape, put it on your shirt or dress, push lightly, pull it off, and hold it sideways up to a light bulb. You'll see a little fuzz on there. Well, that's what we had to work with, fuzz. It had gone through other hands before we had gotten it, and it was stuck sticky side down to a glass slide. And you have to realize that that shroud is old, very old. How old, we don't know. But it has the debris of centuries on it. In addition to little microfibrils, and I'll keep calling them microfibrils because that's all you get with a piece of sticky tape. These are the tiny microfibrils of linen which twisted together in many, many of them finally make up a thread. On this, there was all kinds of debris. There were animal hairs, there was wool, there was silk, there was cotton, there was green polyester. We even found some pink elastic nylon, like in pantyhose. How that ever got on, I'll never know. We found spattered wax, we found fly ash, we found all kinds of insect parts and so on. And you have to work through all that nonsense and try to figure out what's down there. Well, the amount of blood that we saw on the initial slide, which was just a tiny portion of a few microfibrils, we figured out, we didn't know how thick the layer was of blood on the microfibrils. We didn't know whether it was blood, but it looked like old blood. And we'd never seen 630-year-old blood before or 2,000-year-old blood before through a microscope. But we figured that that is what it ought to look like. But we figured also that, given certain assumptions, that we had about 500 picograms, more or less. Now, a picogram is a millionth of a gram. No, it isn't. Yeah, it's a millionth of a gram. And that was out of our league or anybody else's league. 100 nanograms, which is 1,000th of a millionth, that's no problem. But as you get down to less and less, you begin to have problems. And you finally get down to the point where there is no instrument which can measure it. And we were doing a chemical technique which was taking the iron atom out of the porphyrin ring, hitting it with long ultraviolet, which you've heard about before, and causing it to fluoresce red. There was no instrument in existence, nor is there today, that can measure the minute amount of red fluorescence that would have occurred. However, there is one instrument which is a lot more sensitive than anything that's made by man, and it's called the human retina. If you sit in a pitch dark room and you let your eyes dark adapt for about 30 minutes, you can see an incredibly few number of quanta of green light. Green because that's where the eye is more sensitive. I had no idea of how many red quanta you could see. And we decided we'd better start making up some controls. And I have a very unusual wife. She does all kinds of crafts, but she has a very unusual attic. And whenever you have something which is totally bizarre that somebody wants, you ask Maria, would you happen to have? And she gets a kind of unfocused look in her eyes and says, I'll look. And she always comes down with it. So I asked for something really bizarre. I said, do you have any hand-spun, hand-woven, unbleached linen that's a few centuries old that I could have? And her eyes unfocused, she said, I'll look. And she came down 5 minutes later and said, here, it's Spanish, it's 300 years old. So every member of the team, I think, has wound up with a piece of Maria's linen using it for control. So I went and I bled on it, and we studied this blood, and we got down to measurements smaller and smaller, and finally got down to a level where we knew we couldn't go, and yet it was nowhere near the amount that we were seeing on this slide. So we decided, well, we're going to have to give up chemistry here, we're going to have to move to physics. Now you've heard quite a few people talking about taking a spectrum. What they mean, they have already explained to you, and I'll be darned if I'm going to put you through another spectral analysis. In any event, there is one band in the spectrum. It's called the Soré band, and it's unique to porphyrins. I won't try to tell you why at all. But on a spectrum, it looks like Mount Everest. And we figured that maybe we could get a spectrum if we could find a microspectrophotometer. Now, a microspectrophotometer is just like any other spectrophotometer, except it's hooked up to a microscope, and it permits you to go down to 1 micron, which is down around a millionth of a meter. You can't see much below 1 micron in an optical microscope. So you can make a very small beam of light on a very particular particle, and if you have the right instrumentation, you're going to get a spectrum. Unfortunately, in this case, this piece of tape, which was made of mylar and stickum, had been put face down on the slide. So the beam of light had to go through the slide, the stickum, whatever the debris of ages had fallen on there, the red stuff, whatever it was, the fiber, more stickum, the mylar tape on top, and that's going to give you such garbage that you're not going to see much fine structure. However, you should see Mount Everest. Mount Everest, unfortunately, was way down in toward the ultraviolet, and it was dubious whether or not you would see Mount Everest peak. Because if you run out of light down there, because ultraviolet can't go through all that mess that I described, you start to climb up a peak, and you say, hey, great, Mount Everest. And then if you can't really get enough light through, Mount Everest just keeps going and you don't know whether you've climbed something, you're just run out of light. So unless you can go up like this, plateau, and come down the other side, you won't know whether or not you have the Soré band. Well, hallelujah, we found the Soré band, so we knew we had blood. And that's really what we had been kind of supposed to do. But some problems arose because there were others which had suggested that the shroud was a painting and had suggested that there were reasons for this. And among the reasons, it was suggested that the painting was due to an iron oxide earth pigment, like red ochre or Venetian red, which has been used by man since Paleolithic days, in a gelatin binder and that the image was made by a paint of gelatin plus red iron earth oxide. We didn't think that this made an awful lot of sense because of the X-ray fluorescence data that you've just seen, which did not show an increased concentration of iron in the image, and from a whole variety of other spectral work that the other investigators did. So the problem was, well, was there any possibility at all that this might have been a paint? And so we began to take a look at that. And then we figured we ought to worry about the calcium and the strontium and the iron that Larry Schwalbe was just talking about. At that point, we didn't know very much about linen. And at this point, we know more about linen than we ever wanted to know. But what we found out was that up to the 19th century, and still today, if some people make it in the old manner, they take the flax and they put it in a natural body of water for weeks. And good part of the plant falls off, and you wind up with the flax, which you will then wind spin into thread. However, while it resides in the water, it acts as an ion exchange resin, like what the Culligan man does in your basement. And it selectively takes up calcium, iron, and strontium, and that's how the iron got in the shroud. And the calcium, and the strontium. So that made us feel better. We at least had a reasonable reason for explaining why all this was there, and an increased amount of iron in the blood area certainly jived with the fact that we found blood there. There wasn't an increased amount of iron as seen by the X-ray fluorescence people in the image, and indeed when we went down we looked very carefully at the image of microscopy, we couldn't find any iron oxide there, and we couldn't find any protein there. And we used the most sensitive protein detectors that exist, many, a 1,000 to 10,000 times more sensitive than those that have been used before to try to prove that this was a paint, and there was no protein. Then we used some enzymes, which are a mixture of them, which specifically eat up protein, like gelatin, and it did not change the yellow of the image in the shroud. And then we used acids and bases, and when we used all kinds of solvents, and we went through the spectrum of every conceivable paint, pigment, dye, or stain that could have been on the body. And there was no paint, pigment, dye, or stain. So the image had to be something else. The image actually is due to a change in the cellulose itself. And I'll let Dr. Adler speak more about the kind of the change and why it gives us such fits when we try to put all the physics and the chemistry together. We looked for every other conceivable kind of element, and we found only two others which are not of great interest, but we did. We find tiny little black spots. All of this work, incidentally, all the chemistry was done under the microscope, which is a giant pain and takes a terribly long time. So it took us a long time to do all these experiments and get the paper written, not because it was so hard, but because it was just such a pain and such a painstaking kind of an experiment to do. We found around the charred marks in particular tiny little black spots which turned out to be silver. And in terms of the fact that there was molten silver that fell in during the 1532 fire, that's not surprising. And then on one slide, we found a particle which looked optically like cinnabar, which is an ore containing mercury sulfide, which when ground up is the painter's inorganic vermilion. And we found this one particle which had been broken off and dragged across one slide. There is a doctrine in science called necessary and sufficient, and you can bring it to bear here. You say, well, if you want to show that this is a painting, you have to show that they're pigments. That's necessary. But it's not sufficient. You have to show that they are there in adequate amounts in order to prove that that particular pigment made the image. But we found later all kinds of blood in the blood areas and blood breakdown products and albumin. but we found only one piece of mercury sulfide, and we consider that an accidental. This shroud was painted in person by over 60 artists, among whom were Rubens and Van Dyck, and we think a few flecks of artist paint got on the shroud. It is not enough to explain the red of the blood color, and the blood is adequate in amount to explain the red. There's another point about the red iron oxide not being a red iron earth pigment, because virtually all red iron earth pigments have contaminants of manganese, nickel, and cobalt, and there was none in the iron on the shroud. The iron in the shroud are two kinds. One picked up by the retting process of making linen, and that is pure iron. And the other is biological from hemoglobin.